From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped about 450 points at the opening bell today after President Trump threatened to hike tariffs on Chinese goods in a series of tweets. Trump's tweets also sent Chinese stocks tumbling to their worst day in more than 2 years. Let's bring in Diane Swonk, chief economist at Grant Thornton. Diane, yesterday Trump tweeted that all Chinese imports will get a 25% tariff shortly. Right now, a portion of them are taxed at 10%. This has had a pretty significant impact on the markets.
That is certainly a huge impact. And if it were to come true, the reason markets are reacting is because the ripple effects through both the U.S. and the Chinese economy would be quite large. You're talking about virtually everything people buy at almost all stores. Many of them come from China. So it's consumers who bear the burden of this. There's been several economic studies on this now that all of the tariff costs have been borne by U.S. consumers. We also know there's retaliation, of course. Bankruptcies in the farm sector because the retaliation that the Chinese have taken have surged to their highest level since the height of the crisis in 2010. So I think these are very important things to take into account. We were on the edge of thinking we would have some kind of a deal, although many of us were concerned that any deal we had would be a short-term ceasefire. We certainly hope that we still get to some kind of a deal, but really there is the gap between the two countries and what needs to be done and what wants to be done by the two sides is really quite large. They're to that final point where getting the last mile is the hardest mile to close.
So why would the president make this threat then? Is this just an negotiating tactic ahead of this meeting?
Well, I don't want to get inside of the head of the president. I would hope that it's only a negotiating tactic, although the more he does this, the more it has ripple effects on other negotiations we've got coming up with both the European Union on vehicle and parts imports and the Japanese. And the problem is these bilateral agreements do really require, they almost institutionalize trade wars because they require that if someone violates them, you don't have the pressure of the peer group that you do in a multilateral trade agreement. So the only reaction, the only enforcement mechanism is to turn around and slap tariffs and quotas and get retaliation, which cause a lot of economic pain instead of getting people back to the negotiating table because of the whole rest of the world is not in agreement with them. And in fact, we know we have many allies around the world that do not like the way China does business and are willing to work with us to put pressure on China, but we've sort of cut that aspect of the negotiations off.
After the president's tweets, you tweeted, "Fed back on high alert, my head is spinning." What what do you think that this means for the Fed, which had already said that for the rest of this year, it's unlikely to raise interest rates again?
Well, it's certainly not likely to raise interest rates. What it does is up the ante that the Fed would have to do a preemptive cut in rates if, in fact, the tariffs were put in place and they started to see things weakening economically. And this is something that I think is really important is, you know, the Fed is in the position of having to clean the mess of this up. Remember when the Fed was criticized for being tone deaf back in December when they were talking about automatic pilot and where they were on their balance sheet, even though they had cut back on the number of rate hikes they expected. That was when we saw, again, tariff man. We saw the threat of a full-blown trade war. And the kind of disorderly market reactions this can cause are something that can pull the Fed into action. And the Fed has made it clear they do not want to be blamed for taking this economy down. This is not their fault. Trade negotiations are not part of their purview, but it is their job to deal with mopping up after the mess is made.
Well, and by the way, the president, it's clear, wants the Fed to cut interest rates again. So is he pushing the Fed to do just that?
Well, this would be a strange way to do it, is to try to preempt and actually trigger an actual recession for the Fed to do it. That's not what anyone would like. And given what his statements are about what kind of growth he'd like, using these tariffs is not the best mechanism of getting there.
Diane, this comes just a few days after a pretty good jobs report. We've got unemployment right now at a 50-year low. The stock market still near record highs. Wages going up. Overall, is the economy as good as it looks on paper?
The economy is on solid footing. It's slowing from the pace we saw in 2018 and 2019, but it's still on very solid footing. And that's the important thing. And that's part of the reason why Chairman Powell has been sort of, you know, reluctant to do a preemptive cut in rates, because they want to keep their ammunition to battle a real faltering economy, not one that's still generating so many jobs.
That is Diane Swonk, chief economist at Grant Thornton. Diane, thanks as always.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, today, the House Judiciary Committee is moving towards contempt charges against Attorney General William Barr after Barr did not meet a 9 a.m. deadline for turning over Robert Mueller's unredacted Russia report. The Justice Department says House Chair Gerald Nadler's subpoena is overly broad, but here's Nadler this morning.
Compliance with congressional subpoenas is not optional, and if good faith negotiations don't result in a pledge of compliance in the next day or two, the next step is seeking a contempt citation against the Attorney General.
House Democrats are operating under a legislative subpoena system that gives lawmakers authority to investigate in order to pass laws. But our next guest says for stronger subpoena power, they need to start an impeachment inquiry, the process lawmakers use to decide if a president should be tried. Michael Conway was counsel to the House Judiciary Committee in the 1974 impeachment inquiry of President Nixon. So, Michael, we just heard Nadler say compliance is not optional, that the next step is contempt charges. But does that really have teeth?
Well, it depends on what Congress will do with the contempt citation. I mean, theoretically, the entire House has to vote on the contempt hearing. And if they do, Congress literally has the power to attempt to arrest Attorney General Barr. But the last time they did that was in 1935.
Right.
And so the option then is, do you go to court to seek a court order enforcing the contempt, or is it just simply a symbolic action and there are no practical consequences?
Because on paper, we understand that defying a congressional subpoena for testimony or documents is a misdemeanor crime. It's punishable by 1 to 12 months in jail. But it's rare that a Justice Department is going to charge an official who defies a subpoena if he defies it at the president's direction. I mean, there's so many ways to override this.
Well, and the idea that the Justice Department prosecutors are going to criminally prosecute their boss for contempt is a little far-fetched.
Yeah.
In this particular case, the question also is it just Barr who's being held in contempt, or is it the president who literally is instructing Barr not to provide the report?
Well, and you say that there is a way around this and that you feel it's almost a moral imperative for Congress to do that, and that's impeachment. Why does starting impeachment proceedings change things? Take us back to the Nixon era.
Sure, it'll change things fundamentally. So the same thing occurred in April of 1974 when the House Judiciary Committee, which then was conducting an impeachment inquiry, it had been authorized by the House by a vote of 410 to 4, issued subpoenas for what we now know are the White House tapes and documents. Mm-hmm. President Nixon defied the subpoena. In a staff report, and the staff that I served on as counsel, three options were listed that Congress could do. One is to hold a contempt proceeding, which is apparently under consideration right now. The second is to go to court to enforce the subpoena. And the third is to actually treat the resistance as itself an act of impeachment, an impeachable offense, in the sense that the president would be, or in this case, Barr would be, thwarting the congressional subpoena.
Well, and so articles of impeachment were voted on, and there was a final report from this committee that you counseled in 1974 to the House saying, unless the defiance of the committee subpoenas under these circumstances is considered grounds for impeachment, it's difficult to conceive of any president acknowledging that he's obligated to supply the relevant evidence necessary for Congress to exercise its constitutional responsibility for an impeachment proceeding. In other words, unless we do this, unless we consider this grounds for impeachment, we can't see it sets a precedent for other presidents always avoiding impeachment.
Absolutely. The logic of the committee was very strong, which was that Congress has the sole authority to consider impeachment. If the president can unilaterally frustrate their ability to investigate whether there's impeachable offenses, that itself can be an impeachable offense. And in the final report, and the report was from the committee to the full House, because the full House was going to vote. Now, meanwhile, President Nixon resigned. It never came to a vote in the full House. But it simply said the language you've very appropriately quoted, which is that if the president can frustrate Congress's sole executive power of impeachment by stonewalling, that itself can be grounds for impeachment.
So are you saying that this House today needs to open up at least an impeachment inquiry to demonstrate that this administration would not be cooperating with that? I mean, in other words, for the same reason as the one given in 1974, so it doesn't set a precedent.
Exactly. Right today, Congress is attempting, and the report today issued by the staff talks about congressional oversight for possible legislation. But the courts have said, and the Supreme Court has said, the power of Congress to enforce those subpoenas is not as strong in that context as it would be if there were an impeachment inquiry underway. It does not mean that Barr or Trump will actually be impeached. It means that Congress is launching an official impeachment inquiry to see whether they should be.
That's Michael Conway, counsel to the House Judiciary Committee in the impeachment inquiry of President Nixon in 1974, weighing in on today's events. Michael, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And we learned today that the House may vote on contempt charges against Barr on Wednesday. We will follow this story.
It's been almost 3 years since 49 people were killed by a gunman at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando. The shooter swore allegiance to ISIS, but he targeted a gay bar, making it the deadliest incident of violence against LGBT people in American history. Before that, the title belonged to the Upstairs Lounge in New Orleans, where 32 people were killed in 1973. Back then, because so many gay Americans were in the closet, many families of victims didn't want to come forward to say their loved ones had been inside. Robert Fiesler tells the story of the fire in his book Tinderbox, The Untold Story of the Upstairs Lounge Fire and the Rise of Gay Liberation. He joins me now. Robert, welcome.
Happy to be here, Jeremy.
So until the Pulse nightclub shooting, this was the worst attack on the gay community in American history. 1973, a gay bar in New Orleans called the Upstairs Lounge. Tell us what happened.
So on the night of June 24th, 1973, a group of about 100 working-class gay men were gathered at a secret second-story bar located on the ragtag fringe of New Orleans' famous French Quarter, and they were gathered for what was then the biggest party of the week at this bar called the Beer Bust. This was New Orleans in the 70s, so the Beer Bust drink special was $1 for 2 hours of unlimited draft beer. Okay, this is for people who are having quite a bit of fun. In the midst of the Beer Bust, a lot of these gay men who lived secretive, closeted lives, but who were open and out inside this haven, inside this secret second-story bar. In the midst of this this crazy conviviality, a man picked a fight, and that gentleman was ejected from the bar. And as he was ejected violently, drunkenly, he screamed, quote, "I'm going to burn you all out." Mm-hmm. And about 30 minutes later, a spark was lit in the downstairs staircase that had served as the lone entrance and exit to this quite popular French Quarter borderline gay bar. And that led to a terrible cataclysmic tragedy. Essentially, everything inside the bar, turns out, was flammable. And within a span of less than 20 minutes, 29 people were dead. And about three others were doomed to agonizing deaths in a hospital burn ward. So as you mentioned, it was the deadliest event to strike the LGBT plus community of America for about 43 years until the Pulse nightclub shooting in Orlando, a record that never should have been broken.
But the difference, one of the differences between what happened in New Orleans and the Pulse nightclub shooting is after it happened, many of the victims' families didn't even want to claim that their loved ones were in there because it was so taboo to not just be gay, but to be connected to somebody who was.
Correct. It was a very different time period. So in 1973, when you look at values opinions polls, 70% of Americans believed homosexuality to be always wrong. And when they were polled as well about First Amendment rights for homosexuals, about whether or not a gay person should be allowed to speak in public, one-third of Americans disagreed with that. So the gay community, in so much as the word gay was even used in the 70s, was so sidelined and marginalized that the reaction to this fire was not one of sympathy. It was one of embarrassment and humiliation.
Well, and in fact, one of the things that you write in this book is that some of the people who survived didn't want to tell people how they were injured.
Absolutely, because they would face consequences in their own lives, a range of personal and professional consequences. There were no laws protecting gays in the workplace at that time period. Most gay people in New Orleans lived very careful existences where their bosses and coworkers did not know where they went to on the weekends and at nights in the course of their private lives. So there was a real possibility for some of these survivors that if people found out at their workplaces that they had been in the bar that burned the night before, they would lose their jobs, and thus a lot of men had to go to work the next day, that Monday, and act like they didn't know what happened.
Why did you want to tell the story of what happened at the Upstairs Lounge so many decades later?
Well, this was a pivotal event at the crossroads of early gay liberation, the early LGBT rights movement that's like smack in the middle between the Stonewall riots, which kicked a lot off politically in 1969, and then the anti-Anita O'Brien orange juice boycotts in 1977, which is a little bit up prior to the assassination of Harvey Milk the following year. So it's this vital, forgotten, buried event that's what journalists might call a blue whale. It's this event that sounded and sank in the past, dwelled unspoken for years and decades, and then it resurfaced in our present time, specifically in the wake of the Pulse nightclub shooting, when people were looking for context, grasping for anything to try to understand that terrible field of slaughter in Orlando. The Upstairs Lounge fire resurfaced in that span of time, and it sings this really strange song of a very different past, a shocking one that's about what life was like for gay men at a certain place in a certain time.
How difficult was it for you to research what happened? Because even the news articles that came out right after the Upstairs Lounge fire didn't give a lot of information about exactly what was going on. They were being careful about saying that this was a gay bar, etc.
Sure, it was difficult. One of the more difficult things actually was not from a news perspective, actually. For about 2 days following the fire, the Upstairs Lounge fire was the prototypical hot, amazing true crime story. And you can find examples of coverage in newspapers in London, newspapers in Paris, newspapers in Australia. So this was international news. It wasn't until people learned the nature of the bar that had burned and the character of the individuals who had died inside the bar that this was a gay bar that had served gay clientele, that all news coverage disappeared and dissipated. Because in large part at that time period, a general public readership was not going to be able to muster sympathy for those kind of victims. And newspapers and media outlets understood that.
Including the New York Times.
Absolutely, absolutely. Which a famous reporter actually did the original Upstairs Lounge coverage in the New York Times, a gentleman named Roy Reed, who was a famous Southern civil rights reporter. But Roy Reed, I actually was able to get one of the final interviews that he ever gave prior to his death a few years ago, actually, where he spoke about, he said that his coverage of the Upstairs Lounge fire was the first instance where the New York Times had actually assigned him a story to cover the gay community, and he thinks they did it by mistake. He thought they did it at that time period because they were interested in a true crime story, another deadly event to strike downtown New Orleans, rather than the homosexual angle, which he did actually end up pursuing.
What do you think that this story says about where we are today as a nation? Obviously, it's a very different time for LGBTQ Americans.
I think this event speaks to today, especially when you're looking at this summer. It's the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall riots. So that's causing a half-century look back at the LGBT plus rights movement. And what the Upstairs Lounge fire does is it shows us that we shouldn't just celebrate our triumphal march to civil liberties, actually, but it's important to recall and remember the lost history of atrocities, such as the Upstairs Lounge fire, such as the AIDS epidemic, such as countless other examples of violence and individuals of the queer community who fell in the intervening years, because our acts of memory are viable acts of protest now.
By the way, you mentioned the AIDS epidemic. Some of the victims of the Upstairs Lounge fire ended up dying of AIDS
a decade later. They perished in the intervening years, tragically. Could you imagine surviving such a terrible, traumatic event in your youth and then dying in the epidemic slowly?
Well, and agonizing. One that you're keeping quiet after the Upstairs Lounge fire. You don't want to talk about it with everybody and then having to deal with the same thing with AIDS.
With AIDS hysteria and the stigma that followed, yes.
You actually live in New Orleans now.
I do.
Have you been to the area where the Upstairs Lounge was?
I pass by it every day, and I pass by the monument, that was laid down at the 30th anniversary of the tragedy by an individual. He was a gay pastor who fought a very lonely battle in the late 90s and early 2000s in New Orleans to set down this 32-inch by 32-inch bronze plaque that's before the historic door of the upstairs lounge. And every day I read the names of the victims. And it's not just me. I notice oftentimes when I pass on my way to the library where I write in the French Quarter now, I see a lot of strangers and I see a lot of tourists pausing and pondering and wondering. And it's actually a very moving thing to see, because you can see how that monument is advertising the event and has caused and raised awareness. In a sense, one could argue that it's helped give birth to all of the scholarship on the upstairs lounge fire that's actually come out into the public domain in the past few years. I mean, this event that was considered obscure, unknown, to a certain extent, it was considered irrelevant to LGBT canon, is now on the map. And I think a real reason why it's on the map is because it was considered worthy of a monument.
And yet, I just spoke recently with the family members of one of the victims of the upstairs lounge, Ferris LeBlanc, whose body was put into an unmarked grave. They're still trying to get his remains.
They are. They are still fighting Louisiana bureaucracy for the ability to exhume their beloved family member, Ferris LeBlanc, who served honorably in World War II and is worthy of military burial rights in a family plot. And he still lays in this out-of-the-way, decrepit field where the family has been trying for several years now to get to him, unable to do so. Strangely enough, and we still see this again, the upstairs lounge fire was swept under the rug so brutally in the 70s that to this day, those who are trying to raise awareness, honor the victims, are still facing a struggle. The upstairs lounge fire is still, in a sense, contemporary news.
That's Robert Fiesler. His book is called Tinderbox, The Untold Story of the Upstairs Lounge Fire and the Rise of Gay Liberation. It's out in paperback this summer. Robert, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
This message comes from Here and Now's sponsor, Ember Wave. Ember Wave, the revolutionary new personal thermostat that is designed to help you find thermal wellness in any situation. Ember Wave can put you in control of your comfort in places like your freezing office, uncomfortable airplanes, cold restaurants, after a workout, at home, and more. Named one of Time Magazine's best inventions of 2018. Learn more at emberwave.com. Ember Wave, balance through temperature.
Human beings have pushed up to 1 million the number of species of animals and plants on the verge of extinction. These what should be alarming findings are from a new UN panel report from over 450 scientists, which detail how humans have overfished the world's oceans, polluted land and sea, turned forest and grasslands into farms and cities, with devastating consequences for the natural world. Dr. Rebecca Shaw is the chief scientist for the World Wildlife Fund. She was part of the final shaping of this report. And Dr. Shaw, we are so numb to these alarming reports. Why is this one more alarming?
I think one of the most important things you can take away from this report is that the species are declining. And we've heard a lot of media reports, and there's been many scientific articles about the sixth mass extinction, in which we're losing species at a faster rate than all history on Earth. The thing that's really striking about this report, however, is that it also pivots to talk about the health of ecosystems. So when species come together to form grasslands or coral reef, they're coming together to form an ecosystem. And those ecosystems actually produce benefits for people that sometimes go unnoticed. But if you think about it even a little bit, you know from your school days that ecosystems underpin the economies, our food security, and our health around the globe. And I think that that is the thing that is really different about that report, is this is the first most comprehensive report that actually observes and records the decline of ecosystems, the healthy soils that produce an abundant food supply, or intact forests that clean the air by pulling CO2 out of the atmosphere, or wetlands that filter water. They're all being destroyed by human activity and by our productive activities. And it really is a time for us to think about how we change those activities, not just because we love to know that there's elephants and giraffes on the planet, but because it's for our very survival.
Right. I always wonder how we see the extinction of animals and don't understand that we're on that list too, you know, as mammals.
But, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But I was shocked to see in the report that climate change, which we know is such a huge problem, isn't even the number one cause of this. The number one cause is the overuse of land, you know, the development of cities, the taking away of the land space that these ecosystems need to survive.
Yeah, for all you hear about climate change, you would be surprised that it wouldn't be the number one source of the impacts to ecosystems and to species. But it's certainly a major driver of changes that we're seeing. But when you actually go out and you destroy the land or you clear forests, tropical rainforests, to produce more food or to raise cattle, you actually lose a number of species, but you also lose all the productive activity of those forests. Ecosystems are not only impacted by climate change, but they're also a part of the fight against climate change. So we need to be much smarter moving forward, so we're managing, restoring, and protecting our ecosystems so that they protect us and continue to sustain us long into the next century.
That's Rebecca Shaw, chief scientist for the World Wildlife Fund, also part of the report from the UN that found that over 1 million plants and animals are on the verge of extinction. Rebecca, Dr. Shaw, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, and it was a pleasure to talk to you today.
May is Skin Cancer Awareness Month. The most dangerous form, malignant melanoma, will kill more than 7,000 Americans this year. But how do you know if you have it? Or for that matter, how does anyone know if any of those rashes, moles, or just plain weird things they have are dangerous or will become dangerous? Of course, there's no replacement for a visit to a doctor's office. But maybe an app can be the step that will get people there. One is called First Derm. It sends your photos to trained dermatologists who can in turn recommend a visit to a dermatologist. The developer of First Derm is Dr. Alexander Bourve, surprisingly an orthopedic surgeon. He joins us from Barcelona. And Dr. Bourve, we understand you realized there was a need for such an app after going to a few parties with your ex-girlfriend, who is a dermatologist?
Yes, she was always asked about some kind of rash or mole where people, because of convenience, would ask her then and there.
Well, so first of all, we just want to reinforce that, especially as you get older, it's a good idea to have an annual checkup with a dermatologist. But you've also come up with this app. Tell us how it works. You have a database, first of all. How does it work?
You can upload any image and you're anonymous. We don't collect your personal details like email, phone number. We just collect an image and then you pay for it. And then we have a dermatologist that look at the image and they will send them back an answer on what they think it is. And now over time, since we've collected so many images, we have also moved into using these images for machine learning, which means that you can show and teach it how to assess these images. And then over time, they can then start comparing the images which you upload, like new images.
Well, and this is where they become a little bit like a doctor, because First Derm becomes smarter.
That's correct.
Yeah.
So you can imagine these computers, they're so powerful today. You know, they're kind of like brains, really. So if you feed the brain, let's say, 1 million images, it will manage to process these 1 million images in just a couple of hours. Compared to a dermatologist, to process 1 million images, it would take many, many, many years, because they see about 3,000 patients per year.
Yeah. Well, and your database has about 300,000 pictures loaded into it. But a couple questions here. Anytime I've ever asked a dermatologist who isn't my own skin doctor, which I have, you know, somebody I go to every year, they always say you should get that checked. Because what's the liability if your doctors on your app say, no, we don't think that's a problem, and they're wrong?
That's correct. So, you know, we're very risk adverse. We don't take any risks. So all forms of skin cancer does change. So we always tell the user that, look, right now it looks fine. However, if it changes, then you should really go to the dermatologist's office and have it checked out, either with just something called a dermoscopy, which is a magnifying glass, or you'll have to do a skin biopsy.
Well, and you've had an experience where at least one person found something that was immediately of concern.
Yes, so I've had two people that I found malignant melanoma on through our app. And my family, they found skin cancer, but not malignant form of skin cancer using the app. So It is a very good and fast app to get a first opinion. So, for example, my friend, he told me that I'd like to buy you a beer because I think you saved my life. And he had actually used my app on a mole that had been changing. And the doctor said that they could not rule out malignant melanoma. You should get it checked out. He had it checked out. And it was the first stage of malignant melanoma. So he caught it very, very early.
What is the cost to consumers? You say you pay to upload a picture.
So it starts from $29 and then it goes all the way up to $59. So it all depends on how fast you would like the answer.
And again, are you worried that you might either, you know, keep somebody from a doctor's office who should actually be in the doctor's office, or just miss something?
Until today, we haven't missed anything. And also through my research, it also shows that there are very few times that you would miss something. And if you do miss something, it's not usually malignant melanoma. It would be some other form of skin cancer, which is not deadly.
Well, and I guess the thinking is that, you know, people just don't want to go to the doctor. Sometimes people don't want to know bad news. And in this case, it's an app they might be playing with, looking at the pictures that are there, and they're more likely to start thinking about their health care than they would without it.
And many females, they take pictures of their partner. So their partner, they don't go to the doctor, but they say, hey, I have this app, let's check it out. And then when they get an answer in the app which says that you should go and see the doctor, then their partner actually listens up and actually goes in.
That's Dr. Alexander Bourvet. He's founder of First Derm. It's an app that identifies skin problems through artificial intelligence. To find out more, go to hereandnow.org. Dr. Bourvet, thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Well, the NASCAR racing season is in high gear, and so is Formula E racing. Formula E cars are sleek and muscular, but they're all electric. As KQED's Craig Miller reports, promoters hope they will redefine motorsports.
I admit it, I'm old school. When I was growing up, the Indianapolis 500 was the sporting event I waited for all year, and still is.
Drivers, start your engine!
And let's face it, for generations of race fans, it's not just about the speed and the danger, it's the sound. So it might be hard to imagine that being replaced by this.
It's a whine and a whoosh.
Yeah.
And that is a different sound, and I think that's you'll probably need a younger generation to grow up with that.
Steve Page is the CEO of Sonoma Raceway, which has hosted all manner of motor racing. NASCAR still has a stop at Sonoma, but IndyCar just wasn't profitable for the track, so Page gave up on that after last season.
One more lap of Sonoma Raceway.
Page can envision that slot being filled by Formula E, but wonders if they're missing two critical components. One is high-profile drivers, and of course,
that would be noise, yes.
Formula E cars look something like Formula One or Indy cars, though the newest generation look more like the Batmobile than anything else. They top out at more than 170 miles per hour. But can cars that sound like electric drills build the U.S. fan base?
That's the big unknown. I mean, one of the things about motor racing is that visceral appeal, that sense of speed and sound and vibration.
And power.
And power.
But we're not talking golf carts either. Formula E cars go from 0 to 60 in less than 3 seconds. That's competitive with the conventionally powered Formula One cars, considered to be the quickest in racing.
This is a race to the future.
Bob Kowalewski is betting on it. At the Global Climate Summit in San Francisco last fall, he was showing off a sleek white Formula E car from the Mahindra racing team.
That we go to cities around the world, cities that are conscientious about sustainable, renewable, and really what we're doing is promoting EVs.
They build temporary street courses, usually right downtown, pulling in tech-savvy urban millennials to watch the races. There's even a crowdsourcing element called Fan Boost. It gives five drivers with the most votes some extra juice for the race.
The demographic is younger. They're more high-tech. You're not going to get a guy who's watching NASCAR to watch Formula E.
Guys like Max Martin, maybe. What do you think of Formula E? Martin is 28 and a race mechanic at Flying Lizard Motorsports, based at Sonoma Raceway. And that's a 10-cylinder Audi he's revving up in the shop.
I still like the raw power of the V10s and the V8s, but it's all racing, so it's all got four wheels and a motor. It's all good stuff.
All five lights are on, and we go green in Marrakech. Good start from Ben.
Watching Formula E does take some getting used to. Instead of turbo boost and RPM, announcers talk about turning up the kilowatts.
Now they're on a 180 kilowatt lap, a race power mode lap, and then they'll turn it up to 200.
Major automakers are getting on board. Audi, Mercedes, and Nissan are there, and Ford just announced it's eyeballing Formula E for the near future. The technology developed for the track will quickly find its way into EVs in dealer showrooms. But with just one U.S. stop on the circuit, New York in July, how fast will it find its way onto more American race courses? I mean, drivers, throw your switches? For Here and Now, I'm Craig Miller in San Francisco.
The entire staff of the New Orleans Times-Picayune will need to find new jobs. All 161 staffers learned they would be laid off last week after the paper and its website were sold off. Some may be rehired by the new owners, but this is just the latest sign of how the news industry is being torn apart in the digital age. Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. He joins us as he does each Monday from New York. Hi, Derek.
Hey, Jeremy.
So the Wall Street Journal had a big piece over the weekend about haves and have-nots of the news industry. Local newspapers and news sites like the Times-Picayune have been the losers in this story.
Yeah. About one in seven newspapers in the U.S. have lost more than half of their newsrooms since 2004. Many of those that haven't gone away entirely have essentially become ghosts. Some watchers, some analysts call them literally ghost newspapers. And this is a real tragedy, not only to those reporters and editors and copywriters who are losing their jobs with these newspapers, but also for these cities, for these metro areas that are now in a world where you have some jobs in journalism that are concentrated on the coasts, but not enough journalism jobs in the middle of the country, in the heartland of the country, actually looking at what's happening in local government, in local businesses to root out corruption and take stock of the powerful, which is what journalism should be all about.
And one of the culprits here is the tech companies, Google, Facebook. They've sucked up 77% of the digital advertising revenue in local markets, 58% nationally. How much do they factor into what's going on?
Well, they're an enormous part of this picture, and the internet is an enormous part of this picture. You know, a newspaper is a bundle, obviously. It arrives as a bundle, but it's also a bundle of services. It's advertisements served against articles that an individual might not read, but because they have to buy the entire thing, they're therefore supporting a network of journalists and companies that they might not be coming into direct interaction with. That's how the newspaper business got so big, is through these print monopolies in local areas. But what the internet essentially did is it uncrossed all of these subsidies. So if you were, say, trying to sell a car, you wouldn't necessarily have to go through a local newspaper. You could start it. You could, you know, advertise on a car website. If you wanted to sell a couch, you wouldn't have to sell a classified ad in a newspaper. You could go to a national classifieds website. And so essentially what's happened is that as advertising has become a lot more efficient, and Google and Facebook have made it so much more efficient for
advertisers to find their ideal consumer, it's made it more difficult for newspapers that were at least initially built on a less efficient mode of advertising. So in many ways, what's happening here is that as advertising has become better at finding individuals, newspapers have been left behind as that bundle strategy has essentially unwound. And it's made Google and Facebook some of the richest companies in the world, but it's also really sapped away a lot of jobs, a lot of newspapers from so many American cities.
Okay, so we've talked about the problem here. Let's talk about some solutions. One of them, apparently, for local newspapers is that they're being bought up by hedge funds. Is that working?
No, it's not working. So as newspapers became a distressed asset, they attracted a lot of attention from hedge funds. But those hedge funds aren't in the news business. They're in the profit business. And right. In this case, they're in the profit extraction business. So last year, I spoke with the managing editor of the Denver Post, which was bought out by a hedge fund called MNG. MNG said, we want to focus on immediate profits here. Well, how do you focus on immediate profits with a company that has declining revenue? What you do is you fire a lot of people, and that's precisely what the hedge fund did. They're taking out cash as quickly as they can to put that into other businesses that are growing faster. Now, that might be a strategy to run a successful hedge fund for a decade, but it's not a strategy to save the news. It's a strategy to treat newspapers like wet sponges, to be wrung out, liquidated, and then thrown away.
Well, the other option, I guess, is the Washington Post model, and you have a billionaire, Jeff Bezos, stepping in, buying that paper, pumping a ton of money into it. It's unclear, though, whether, you know, it will make enough money to be able to do that when it doesn't have a rich person coming up and saying, here, I'll give you the resources you need to do the reporting. And local newspapers aren't going to have that kind of support.
That's right. So you have if the money's not going to come from hedge funds, maybe it'll come from billionaire benefactors. Maybe it'll come directly from readers. What you've seen essentially with the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post is that a lot of newspapers have essentially said, we've lost the advertising war to Google and Facebook. We're never going to be the advertising machine that they are. What we need to do is to shift our business from advertising to subscribers. We need to ask our readers to prove our worth by paying us money every single month. That has worked for some national newspapers that are essentially utilities. There are millions of readers who feel like they need the New York Times. There are business people, businessmen and businesswomen who feel like they need the Wall Street Journal or the Financial Times. So those newspapers have done a relatively successful job transferring their business towards subscriptions, but it's been very, very difficult for other newspapers to do the same.
Well, I hope they figure out a way to get the money that they need to stay in business because, as you've said, local newspapers are really important to make sure that people all across this country know what is going on in their communities. Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, thank you.
Thank you.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here Now.